In the debating I did, wondering just what I'd talk about, I've had a tremendous experience in the University of Michigan recently. And in a group of faculty members, after our task was completed, they threw at me one of the most challenging questions of my lifetime. What has Mormonism given to America that America didn't already have? And the question has so intrigued me that I've been spending the spare time that I don't have trying to run that down, and I really made up my mind that's what I was going to talk about. Until a week ago, I had the privilege of going with one of your fine faculty members to a conference, and I was so proud of his performance. And as I drove by, I took another look at the Y on the Hill. And that Y has been in my mind ever since. Some things you don't know. As far back as 1922, the student body officers of this institution gave me one of the few unearned official Ys, which I treasure. Back in 1922, believe it or not, I think I won't make mention of the people who were then here. I tell you, you never can suspect what some of you may become. Well, I keep that why, and always shall honor it. And it's put the theme into my mind that I want to talk about. I read again the speeches that were made in these assemblies last year, and I discovered that most of us, practically all of us, took a religious theme. And that's altogether fitting, because this is a church institution. But I sometimes wonder whether we give the proper emphasis to another aspect of a great university. At any rate, I want to do it today. It's the privilege of members of our board to interview each teacher who comes here to work with you. As far as I know, it's the only board with which I've ever been connected, the members of which undertake to visit with prospective teachers. And we always lay the emphasis, I know I do in my conferences with these men and women, that the first responsibility is to anchor you fine young men and women to the faith of our fathers. And that must always be basic in this institution. But this is not a seminary. This is a great university. And I think it must always have two great foundational principles underlying it. The first is a solid and a substantial faith. But in my book, the second one is a creative and vigorous scholastic foundation which will assure to those of you who come that you shall have been led into the ways of scholarship and have sounded the depths of your intellectual souls out across the great tomorrow that can be yours. And I'm happy to belong to a church, and I take a continuing pride in it. No man in this church has ever warned me against the inquiry of the mind, and for that I'm grateful. I'm happy in the thought that I belong to an institution which in its 13th article of faith bids me to go out and search the wide world over for the truths that have come to mark civilization. And I come to you with a conviction, and I pass it on to you as I hurry by. Don't ever let yourselves get disturbed that there may be conflict as between revealed religion and the search of science. One day we'll complete the search, and because we believe in continued revelation, one day there will be brought together in complete harmony the full findings of truth in science and the full findings of truth as revealed by God. And when the story is written fully, we'll discover that they join hands together as great allies and never as enemies. Well, having seen the Maya on the hill, I'm coming to you with something I haven't found in a book, and I suppose it oughtn't ever to be in one. But I've been looking at the Y on the hill, and somehow I'd like to leave it with you. It's wonderful that you have the Y on the hill, and I discover that each year you go up to make sure that you renew its whiteness. I hope every student here has a Y in his heart, which every day he brightens into the newness of the glory that can come through a full appreciation of the Y. And to simplify it, perhaps too far, I've been turning over in this last week the things that I'd really like to leave with you. You who love and honor the Y. I can't hope that there'll be any spell in this except the simplest of symbolism. I'm sure it's been passed around here now till it's threadbare, but I still remember the trip from Denver over the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad when the porter was asked early one morning as we came through what the Y on the hill stands for. He, with the kind of scholarship that is substantially a minus quality, said, "Well, sir, I don't exactly know unless it stands for Wyoming." As a matter of fact, as I say hello, and when I think of the things that you wonderful people can do, did you ever hear of those two fellows that were out at one of those parties that featured too much fellowship, and they were having difficulty getting home, and they decided in the interest of saving a little distance they'd go cross lots, and that took them through the cemetery, and the first man fell in a newly dug grave that proved to be so deep he couldn't get out. And he had a terrific experience. He would reach in with his toes, you know, kick into the clay, and they'd pull out. And then he'd go in with his fingers, and they'd pull out. And finally, he settled back and lay down at the bottom of the grave and thought he'd wait till morning. He discovered he couldn't get out. A little while later, a buddy who'd been enjoying the same kind of fellowship came along and had the same experience, and he fell in. And the man lying at the bottom of the grave knew that he couldn't say anything. He mustn't. It'd be a voice from the dead. So he lay there in complete silence and watched his buddy go through the same futile attempts to get out. He was in with his toes, too, and then with his fingers, and he was grasping and pulling, and each time he'd fall back. And finally, when the man at the bottom couldn't take it any longer, he said, "You might as well lie down. You can't get out." Now, I've already said that he couldn't get out, but he did. Okay, you sit out there this morning, and I'm honored in your presence, with great potential, with the ability to get out when, you know, when it can't be done. And that's the glory of the first thing I want to leave you about the Y in you, because that's my theme. Y-O-U, the Y in you. For years and years now, we've been welcoming men into Rotary, but I tell the men who come in, just to get your name on the roll never makes you a Rotarian. You're never a Rotarian till you're spurred by the ideals of a great organization. You fine young people come to the Y, but you never really belong to the Y till the Y is in you. Now, I've been turning that over a little bit during the week. And the first Y connotation to me is the youth that's yours. I haven't it in my heart to envy any man anything. But if I did, I'd envy you your years. It's wonderful to be young. I don't know whether you catch it or not. You can work as I did last night till midnight, and you roll over and get a few winks, and you come up in the morning as if you know. It's wonderful to be young. All my life, I've done most of my studying around the middle of the night, and I could wish that I could work as hard as I once did. As President McKay says, as we joke a little bit about this, he says, you know, I'm as good as I ever was for a couple of hours. How I know that, as I look back to the days we used to walk 2 miles to catch a streetcar and then go another 7 miles to get to the university, and it seemed as nothing. We used to drive out to play in an orchestra to dance, and they still like to dance. I don't suppose you've changed any. They always used to tell me the best dancing was after midnight. That's an awful thought to leave here. And then after the dance, we'd drive home with the old horse and buggy, then get up in the morning and walk out a couple of miles to get a streetcar. And we didn't even notice it. That's the glory of youth. With enthusiasm, with resilience, with the qualities that can take it, and you come back with vigor of mind and of body, I wouldn't preach to you this morning. I would just say, every one of you is blessed and equipped with a conscience. And we don't need to belabor you across the pulpit as to what is right and wrong. God inspire you to preserve the springs of youth and keep them eternally pure and fresh. That's preachment enough for any young man or woman that thinks. We oughtn't to have to draw the diagram when conscience bids you to back away. Whatever the circumstance may be, hearken to the quietude of the voice which will never clamor. And if you don't listen, there comes a time when it cannot be heard. God bless you in the days of your youth. In the significance of the spiritual admonition, put your sense of trust in the values that are eternal, and the investment you make in your youth will pay you tremendous dividends all the rest of your days. But if you squander your youth, you'll travel on in mediocrity all the rest of your life, and there is no providence to make up for the energies by way of sacrifice that you should invest in these golden days. You remember Wordsworth's line, writing of the days of the French Revolution, "Bliss was it in that day to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." And yet, as I thought of the why that may be in you, and I want to thank Dr. Tyler, who's doing, in my limited experience, and I wish it were fuller, a wonderful job in your library. And he's so gracious upon the occasion of any request. And I ask him to bring me up to date on the second why, the why of yesterday. This institution just didn't chance to be. It was founded under the inspiration and the revelation of the great Brigham Young. It was pioneered in the days of that great teacher and leader, Carl G. Mazur. And Dr. Tyler sent me Professor Burton's new biography, which I read again last night. And whatever else you do in this great institution, may I bid you to drink deeply at the fountainheads that are here. And if you're really a college student, you will measure the degree of your having matured into real collegiate stature by the amount of time you spend in the library in the presence of the honored dead whose heritage is yours for the taking. With Ulysses, you can be part of all that you've ever met. Now, this school had its struggles. It began, that first institution, and then fire destroyed it. And they housed themselves in a factory or a mill. Those were simple days. But they brought great men and women to the faculty, as they continue to do. And the greatness of any faculty is never any single generation. It has what has come through many generations. And so it's your privilege here to live, if you catch the spirit of the why that's in you, in the yesterdays of this great institution. I almost go back to the day when you had fewer students than you now have faculty members. And I recall the day when we measured in terms of 212 college students. And I remember the prediction that was made you one day would have 1,000 college students, and there were those who thought we were getting a little fantastic. You now have 7,000, and you stand the largest educational institution in the state. I sit on two boards, and I'm now in that happy frame of mind where I can go to a ball game and hope that the better team wins. There are those who never would have dreamed that there would come a day when you would be a larger institution than my alma mater. And it will be larger yet. You one day ought to know what those early patrons did to establish a school. You ought to be grateful one day to the Knight family who prompted generosity on the part of other fine men and women. You ought everlastingly to be grateful for the men who constituted those early faculties, who worked for a pittance, but who served with a devotion that has never been surpassed. And so out of the yesterdays, won't you be mindful that somebody builded for you? I could wish that I might live long enough that in some little measure I might pay back to civilization what civilization has so generously given to me. And once you catch that concept, fellow students, the why of yesterday will dawn upon your consciousness. I want to give you the third why. And it's really the burden of what I wanted to say this morning. Some people struggle through college. Some suffer through it. Some linger through it. And sometimes I suspect that some slumber through it. You're so wonderful here this morning. You're an inspiration. If anybody has a little shut eye this morning, he's artistic. I can't discover it. Look, pool the strength of these men and women who now constitute your faculty. Catch of the inspiration of the men who constitute the administrative quartet. Get their stories. I happen to know them. Get close to the brilliant men of this institution. I thrilled so a week ago to be in the presence of young Harvey Fletcher. And all the time I was with him, I was paying a silent tribute to the father who has won distinction in the greatest centers of learning in America. I was in conference yesterday with Dr. Eyring of the University of Utah, about whom Einstein said he had one of the most brilliant minds he had met in America. And I sit with him and try to grasp in some little measure the great secrets of atomic energy. And I have to confess that I drag along, but I have respect for these fine men. I could name many of them. You know them. And when you found a man with the intelligence that sparkles, keep close enough to him in the hope that a little of it may rub off. I don't know whether there's such a thing as intellectual osmosis, but I hope there may be. Well, this has been a remarkable week to me, and I want to hint it as I lead to a close. I've missed these many years one man that I'm sorry that I didn't take work with at Columbia. I still go back to those days. That was a honeymoon year for us. We were married and went to Columbia. And it was my privilege at Columbia University to meet some men who thoroughly stirred me and lifted me out of myself. That's the purpose of a university. But I missed one of them. His name was Calvin Thomas, and who became one of the great teachers of Columbia. And I want to hint for you just a minute what a man can do. He was reading Scott's Lady of the Lake when he was 6. At 10, he had finished the district school. At 14, he was ready for college, but was denied entrance because they refused to admit them under 16 in those days. In the 2 years that he had to hold back, from 14 to 16, having already read Caesar and Cicero and Virgil, he spent those 2 years reading Greek. When he entered college at Ann Arbor, Michigan, he was the youngest man in the institution. And, so the account says, the smallest. Then he ran into Carlyle, and he said after Carlyle, life was never the same again. Then Goethe and Schiller. Then he turned to German literature, really. He completed with honors and distinction and was given a position in that university, and makes me homesick when I get the assignment they gave for him for his first year of teaching. He gave a course in Terence, the Roman poet. He gave a second course in the writing of Latin. He gave a third course in German literature, and his fourth course was a course in Shakespeare. And he said for diversion, he continued his reading of Greek. I don't want to make you uncomfortable. But among the things that he wrote while he was at Columbia was a little collection of essays featured in speeches which he had given, which he calls Scholarship and Other Essays. And again last night, I'm so grateful I get these assignments once in a while, because you make me do some of the things that we let routine crowd out of our lives. I read his essay on scholarship last night, and I want to close with two or three hints to you. It's wonderful to appreciate the why of youth. It's stirring to get the why of yesterday and the traditions of a great institution. But primarily, I hope you'll take from this morning the why of the yearning for learning. And when I talk about yearning, I mean to have that kind of anxiety of soul that leaves you unsettled and unhappy until you have anchored yourself in the facts that give you the satisfaction. I remember that fourth of the great Beatitudes, Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst. You remember the preceding one, blessed are the meek. And the interpretation of that I like best is, blessed are the teachable. But it isn't enough to be meek. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst. Well, I was hoping it was going to be the carolyn bells, but it's that kind. Okay. Will you let me borrow a minute to say two things out of that book that I closed with yesterday? Knowledge is good. Power is excellent. But inspiration is priceless. And you catch all three of them if you really in your heart desire to know, are willing to take the pains to get the facts, to classify them, to evaluate them, to draw the conclusions, and then to verify the conclusions. And may I remind you, life can always be noble to those who catch the genius of nobility. And at the risk of getting fired, I preached the funeral service last week of young Roland Barker, 36, a research scientist in physical chemistry. And sitting upon the mourner's bench sat the little widowed woman who was the mother of four boys, and Roland one of them. Harold is professor of surgery at Columbia University. Earl is professor of internal medicine at Penn. And Clyde, the youngest, is in his training in medicine in another of America's great universities. And when I shook the hand of that little widow woman, she said, because I knew her husband who was a teacher at the U, if God will preserve in my memory the inspiration of their father Fred and the treasured presence of these boys who without money have worked their way before the board in medical science, which is the top honor that comes to medical men. You're wonderful. God bless you to capitalize the why of youth that is yours and lead you to cherish the why of the memory of the men who've built this institution, and then to yearn for the learning that is yours for the asking. Thank you.